Very good. So we'll be starting with some of the things that I talked briefly about last time. I wanted to begin with this expression that you see in the introduction, the Ignatius Catholic Study Bible introduction. If you look on page 13, there's the introduction begins with the controversy that there is about the dating of the book of Daniel. And there are two schools of thought about this. One is that it is written at the time of the exile. So it's written by Daniel. Maybe at the end of the time, maybe as he's an old man. Maybe it's part of it is written when he's younger, part of it's written when he's older. But in any event, it's written in the 6th century BC at the time of the exile, or as the exile was coming to an end. Okay? Then you'll notice that option two there, very common view in the biblical world, is that Daniel does not write the book. It's written by somebody 3 centuries later, during the time of the Maccabees, and that the events that are happening that are prophesied in the book of Daniel are really ongoing events from the point of view of the author. Okay? And notice that there's this expression. I learned this expression for the first time reading this and then started doing some more background about it. So in that second column on page 13, the visions in Daniel 11 that concern Hellenistic history leading up to the death of Antiochus are quite accurate. This leads many to suggest that the author of Daniel must have lived in the days of Antiochus, was writing about the events of recent history, which he made to look like prophecy by expressing them in apocalyptic language. Indeed, the technique of composing prophecies after the fact, known in Latin as vaticinia ex eventu, and doing so in the name of a revered figure, is said to be a constitutive feature of Jewish apocalyptic writings that appeared at this time. Okay, so the classic version of vaticinia ex eventu is Virgil's Aeneid. Virgil is a Roman poet. He's writing in the court of Augustus, and he writes this book, or this poem, I should say, this epic poem, about the founding of Rome by these refugees from Troy. Remember Aeneas, the one who carries his father on his back out of the burning city, eventually comes to Rome and founds, or comes to Italy and founds Rome. And in book 6, there's this, before he comes to Italy, there's this, he goes into the underworld, like Odysseus does in the Odyssey. And there he sees these visions of the greatness of Rome. Okay? So you have somebody in the time of Augustus writing about this period, let's say 1,000, 1,200 years earlier, in which he's foreseeing the very greatness that is current at the time that the guy is writing. Okay? So it's written as if somehow Aeneas is foreseeing this future greatness, but of course, the author, the greatness is right there in front of him. Right? That's vaticinia ex eventu. You project something into the past that is somehow prophesying something that really is present to you, the writer. And so that is one school of thought about the book of Daniel. Okay? And that's why it is the historicity of Daniel matters. Now, you'll notice in the beginning, or if you read that section, The authors want to lean on the traditional view that Daniel is in fact the author of Daniel. And they admit that there are some things that, in terms of objections against Daniel being written in the 6th century, that aren't easy to answer. Maybe they are answerable, maybe there's more information we need. But at this point, there are things that are sort of puzzles. Okay? And once you get, however, to the to the text, like for example on 17, if you look at the, let's see, the note at the bottom, where is this? Yeah, on 17. So there's the main text of the scripture of Daniel. Then there are these footnotes, right? Chapter 1, verses 1 to 7, 1-1. And then below that, the print gets even tinier. I feel as though I need like another pair of glasses for my first pair of glasses. But anyway, so not in the main body print, not in the tiny print, but the really tiny print below that. The book is composed of two distinct parts. In the first, there are stories about Daniel in the time of the Babylonian Empire. In the second, there are a number of apocalyptic visions ascribed to Daniel foretelling the future. Stories in the first part may be based on original material dating from the time of Daniel, must have been written down later as they betray unfamiliarity with the history of the period. Likewise, the visions of the second part are predominantly concerned with the latter Greek Empire. It's unlikely they were composed before that time. Their literary form, too, corresponds to apocalyptic literature common in the second century. So, on the one hand, in the introduction, they want to lean toward the traditional view, but then when you actually get the commentary on the text, yeah, it's probably this, probably the second view. Now, I have up here this work, Edward Pusey, Daniel the Prophet. If you're not familiar with Edward Pusey, what I refer you to is the so-called Tractarian movement of the Church of England in the 1840s. And the person that you know from the Tractarian movement is John Henry Cardinal Newman. The Oxford movement or the Tractarian movement were these group of Anglican clergy who felt that the Church of England had veered in a direction which was too Protestant. That they had absorbed too much of the Protestant Reformation, and that they really needed to get back to something which was not Roman Catholic, but which was more firmly grounded in the Church Fathers. Because when you read the Church Fathers, it doesn't look Baptist, Methodist, it doesn't look like that. There are bishops, priests, deacons, seven sacraments, prayers for the dead. When you look at the Church of the Fathers, it doesn't look like anything that's low church Protestant or even mainline Protestant. Okay, in fact, early as an Anglican, Newman is the one who made the observation that if the early church, if there was any evidence or any record that the early church looked like low church Protestantism, it has been swept from the pages of history as if by a flood. It simply doesn't look like anything that you would recognize if you were a Calvinist or a Methodist or so on. Okay? John Henry Newman, this movement begins in the 1830s, and it goes about to the early 1840s when the Church of England put the kibosh, basically, on this movement. Newman says, you know, that Tractarian movement, that Oxford movement, would have never gotten off the ground if it weren't for Edward Pusey. When I was writing that, when I started that, I was a curate at Oxford. I was one of the chaplains at St. Mary's, you know, which was kind of one of the campus churches for Oxford. But he says I wasn't somebody important. It was Edward Pusey lending his name and also writing some of those tracts, which now brought it to public attention and gave it seriousness. So to give you an idea of Pusey got in trouble at some point, was silenced by the Church of England because he wrote this public defense of real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And the Church of England didn't want that defined. They didn't mind people believing it, but Church of England always wants to have this kind of broad view that, okay, you have these people and they believe that, and you have these people over here and they believe something different. And here's Edward Pusey saying, the plain language of the scripture and the early fathers is that Jesus is present, body, blood, soul, and divinity in the Eucharist. They didn't want something that blunt and that direct. The earliest translation of St. Augustine's Confessions into English is from Pusey. So in the Britannia Great Books, when you pull down the volume of Augustine and you flip to the the Confessions, that's the Pusey translation. So remember, a lot of the church fathers, they were not available in English. And it was Pusey and Newman and others in Oxford that were translating the church fathers and making them available to a wider audience. So after Newman had already entered the Catholic Church, and Pusey, of course, still remained Church of England and still tried to keep some of those elements of the Oxford movement remaining and vital, he dedicated a whole book to Daniel the prophet in which he argued that what's at stake here is whether Daniel is really a prophet. All of you people who want to say that Daniel is writing in the second century, so really what's going on here is you deny prophecy. That's really at the heart of this, is that you deny that God would select people to foresee the future, and that that would be a kind of supernatural sign that God is with them. That's what you object to. Part of this is there can be textual difficulties or linguistic difficulties or historical difficulties. Those are all worth talking about. But the real issue for you is that you deny prophecy. By the way, in the book of Isaiah, Isaiah will often be divided into two chunks. And so there isn't one Isaiah. There's the author of the one part and the author of the other part. And again, the same thing turns on, well, if you date it earlier, then these things are prophetic, and if you date it later, then it's not. So please be aware that what can sound like just a scholarly kind of argument about whether language or chronicles or secular sources, what can sound like something that's just a scholarly argument in terms of who wrote it, when it was written, really goes back to an issue of faith. Do you believe that God gives prophecy to people or not? And more often than not, what's guiding a lot of biblical scholars is a denial of the gift of prophecy. They don't really believe that. The other person that I should put up here, it's just the commentary on the book of Daniel. And it's by a contemporary here, although maybe he lives a little later. If you want the kind of establishment scripture scholar out of England at the same period, Samuel Rolls Driver. And he has a lot of, and his area of expertise is the Old Testament. His area of expertise is Old Testament. And if you want to go back to kind of the classic arguments against Daniel being written by someone in the 6th century BC, a lot of the things that you would read now, they're all going to go back to Samuel Rolls Driver. Okay? And I have it on my iPad here. Here's the section that I just want to share with you. Because in a way it shows you the mindset of the modern biblical critic when you bring up, you deny prophecy. So here's Samuel Rolls Driver. According to critics, the purpose for which the book of Daniel was written was the consolation and encouragement of the afflicted Jews in the time of Antiochus Epiphanes. For this purpose, imaginative narratives might be employed with perfect propriety and without the smallest intention to deceive. Fiction, even fiction without any foundation of fact whatever, has played an important part in the education of humanity. And religious fiction, written with a didactic purpose, has in both ancient and modern times been valued by teachers as a powerful instrument of edification and has won a remarkable amount of popular appreciation. The Old Testament abounds with instances in which poetry and oratory have been employed by the Spirit of God for the purpose of giving expression to moral and religious truth and of stirring the moral and religious emotions of either those who listened in the first instance to the words of the poet or the prophet or have read them since. And if the imagination be a faculty granted by God to man, capable of being employed in instruction and edification, there is no intelligible reason why, where no fact conditioning a theological verity is concerned, it may not have been made subservient to religious ends. So in other words, let it be fiction, right? Fiction can be inspiring, okay? Only the problem is, the book of Daniel doesn't come off as fiction. Okay, when you read, let's say, the Song of Songs, there is no sense that the king, the princess, the shepherd lover, the various characters in there are anything but characters. It's very clearly a poem. Okay, when Jesus tells parables, there's no sense that in fact he's committing himself to, you know, in fact there really was a guy who was beaten up on the way from Jerusalem to Jericho, right? Very clear. The fact, for example, that none of them have names, right? In parables, none of the characters have names. Okay, throughout Scripture there can be symbolic language, or symbolic narratives, or allegories, and they're very clearly so. But at the point where you can say you have a writer in, let's say, the 3rd century, who is writing as if he was Daniel, giving historical events as if he was Daniel, and that can be, if you like, inspired scripture, then where does that door close exactly? Because you have no real commitment to the historical veracity of Scripture. You have no real commitment to that. The thing can be a collection of legends and myths that's meant to inspire. And the thing that there are other religions, by the way, where the historicity doesn't matter. You know, in Hinduism, it doesn't matter when Krishna arose. It really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if he fought the battle in this century or that century. But think about Christianity. See, it was one of the things that I found so helpful coming into the church was listening to how Archbishop Fulton Sheen would talk about the paper trail that there is to Jesus. Jesus is pre-announced. No other major religious figure is pre-announced. The Buddha is not pre-announced. There isn't something in Hinduism that points to the Buddha coming. Muhammad is not pre-announced. There's nothing in Near Eastern folklore that points to Muhammad coming. None of those folks are pre-announced. Only in Jesus Christ, through the paper trail of the Old Testament, is this major religious figure pre-announced. You are told when he's going to come. You're told what he's going to be like, how he will teach, how he will be born, where he will be born, where he will die, how he will die. This is a historical religion. And if the history that builds up to that event can really be a tissue of myths and legends, the thing collapses. The thing collapses. You know, other religions, it's not as important. In Buddhism, there isn't a history that's important. Hinduism, there isn't a history that's important. But Christianity is built on historical realities that are made evident in the Old Testament. And at the point where there really is no prophecy, or prophecy contains no real truth, that endangers Christianity and its foundations. Yeah, go ahead, Jeff.
Just an observation. I went to college a long time ago, but there was a Catholic priest teaching Old Testament theology, and this very much was the basis of his explanation of the Old Testament, is that much of it was historically not accurate, but that doesn't diminish, you know, the value that this has in terms of inspiring people to be faithful, right? I mean, it is so pervasive, I think.
Oh yeah, that is pervasive. Please understand that when you send your kids off to Catholic colleges, when you're mainline Catholic colleges, you know, not your quirky little places like Thomas Aquinas College or, you know, Christendom or whatnot, but when you're sending them to your mainline colleges, that's what they're getting. Not by way of exception, by the way of rule. That's the standard. That's what your standard Catholic schools, and those of you who've been to Catholic universities, that's your experience. That's what you had. But of course, if there's no historical basis there, there's no reason why you can't be equally inspired by the Iliad or the Odyssey or the Aeneid or Nietzsche's Also Spoke Zarathustra, right? The reason you read the Old Testament is not because it's uplifting in a human way. The reason you read the Old Testament is you believe that God chose those people and revealed himself to them. Okay? I mean, otherwise, it just becomes part of world literature like any other thing of world literature, and not especially better or worse. Right? Very clearly, the book is about God. It's not so much about the people, except a lot of the times, insofar as they like don't listen and don't obey the God. Predominantly, it's about them. Point two, I talked a bit about this last time, but I wanted to address it a little more clearly. The text comes to us in a very strange way. So, in the Septuagint, of course, we have 14 chapters all in Greek, because the Septuagint is a translation. But what it's translating is something that the earliest versions you can find have the first chapter or so in Hebrew, and then chapters 8 through 12 in Hebrew. You have sections basically from the early part of chapter 2 to chapter 7. That's in Aramaic. Please understand, Aramaic is this kind of broad range of languages throughout the Near East. It's sort of like the lingua franca of the Near East. If you were going to be talking to people in Syria and now modern day Iraq and those places, generally you're talking about a family of languages called Aramaic. There are going to be different dialects of it, but Aramaic is what it's going to be. And then there are these sections that we only have them in Greek. So the Canticle of the Three Young Men and the Prayer of Azarias. So basically chapter 3, verses 24 to 90. And then these last two chapters, 13 and 14. We only have those in Greek translation. We don't have them either in Aramaic or Hebrew. Okay. Now, when you look at the Aramaic part, from what we can tell, the Aramaic translates back and forth very easily into Hebrew. And there was a pretty standard people who are writing earlier, people who are writing at the time of, let's say, the Palestinian Jews, let's say 2nd century BC, a little later than that, they write and as if they're aware of this, that there was a Hebrew original that had the whole thing. And when you look at the Aramaic sections, if you're an expert in Aramaic, you can tell there are these little Hebrew touches, as it were. In other words, it looks the way it would if you were translating it from Hebrew and not just writing it originally in Aramaic. Okay? But for whatever reason, whatever original there was that had it in Aramaic or had it in Hebrew, those middle sections got destroyed. But they had another version where it was translated into Aramaic, so they supplemented the parts that were destroyed with the parts that they had. It's entirely understandable that you have a Hebrew original, but as time goes on, you have fewer and fewer people who are speaking Hebrew. So that's why you've got to put it into an Aramaic translation. I mean, think about it this way. You, in the captivity, you get hauled off to a place where no one's speaking your language. And what happens? What happens with your kids? Soon they're speaking Aramaic more than they are speaking whatever language you had back home. You know, like any group that had come to the United States, you come across the border and you're speaking Spanish, but before you know it, your kids from American television, let alone American school, they're sitting there speaking English. Okay? So it's entirely understandable that in fairly short order, there's not only a Hebrew Book of Daniel, there's an Aramaic one, and there's more Aramaic copies than there are Hebrew copies, because there are more Hebrews who speak Aramaic and read Aramaic than there are the original Hebrew. Remember, that's how the Septuagint came into existence. The Septuagint, this translation of the Hebrew Old Testament into Greek, that happened because at that point, there were simply more Hebrews, more of the Jews, who were reading and speaking Greek than they were.